Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast. Sorry, let me start again. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land and elders of recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, let's hope you've had a great weekend. Beautiful day, blue sky, sunshine. Let's hope it'll even be a great day for you. My guests today, Leanne Enoch, joining me live in the studio. Leanne, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm really good, Tiger. Thank you so much for having me today.
Now, you're a campaign officer with the Queensland Council of Unions.
Yes, I've just started working with the Queensland Council of Unions recently.
Yeah. After a number of years with Red Cross.
Yeah, about 7 years with Australian Red Cross.
Yeah. Very good. It's great to have you in here. And Billy Gordon joining me via telephone from way up north. Billy, how are you, brother?
Good. How are you, mate? Good to hear you.
Very well. And great for giving us some of your time.
No worries. Thanks for having us on.
Leanne, first up, tell me your mob, your country.
Oh, so I'm Leanne Enoch. I'm a Noonuckle Noogie woman of the Quandamooka Nation, which takes in the waters and islands of Moreton Bay. So originally from the beautiful island of North Stradbroke Island, but I also have some ancestral ties into the far north. My grandmother was a Kanju woman.
All right. Kanju country. Where's it, Cape Yorkway?
Yeah, it's up near Cowan.
All right. Billy, tell us your mob and country, brother.
So, Barbarum people up here on the Atherton Tableland. It's my mother's people. Very small mob, but very limited edition. And my grandfather's people are from Holmarpoon up on the Cape.
All right. Beautiful country too. So, you've both got connections back into Cape York. Beautiful country.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I was in Aracoon last week and beautiful, definitely beautiful place.
Yeah. Where'd you grow up, Bill?
I'm an Innisfail boy originally. I grew up there in, you know, far north Queenslander. Lived and worked here most of my life. So living and working in Cairns now at the moment. Did some stints in Mount Isa, Brisbane, about a year about Canberra. I worked for Reconciliation Australia for a bit. Back home here now in far north Queensland.
All right. When we're talking today about Murrays, Leanne and Billy, standing as candidates in the next state election. Leanne, you're standing for the seat of Algesta.
That's right.
Last year you were, it was a different seat, Coomera somewhere, where were you?
Oh, well, there were two. What was the story? So two state elections ago I had the opportunity to run in the seat of Coomera, which is down on the Gold Coast. We didn't win in that one, but had the amazing opportunity to learn so much about how it all works. So this time we're running in the seat of Algesta, which is very much closer to where I live and where I've grown up. And, now we get a chance to take all those learnings and put it all into practice in this campaign.
Where'd you grow up?
So I spent my first few years on North Stradbroke Island, of course, on my beautiful country. And then when we moved to the mainland, my parents moved us to the mainland when I started school. So I spent most of my life growing up in the suburb of Woodridge, which is down in Logan.
All right. And didn't you go on to university and do some studies?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, I guess. My parents were incredibly supportive about education. They were very passionate about education. And so, you know, hence the reason why they made a big family move, a huge, you know, decision really to move over to the mainland, hoping that there'd be more opportunities, in terms of education for their kids. I was the first in my family. I think a lot of us had this story, I was the first in my family to go to university. I became a high school teacher and I got to teach in Queensland and in rural Queensland. And then I went over to had a little bit of a time over in London and which is so funny when you think about it, you know, a little Murray girl.
Yeah, Murray girl in London teaching them fellas how to speak English.
Teaching English to English, yeah. So lots of fun times there. But, yeah, so I had the opportunity to have that university education and, you know, be able to teach in lots of different locations, which really, you know, gave me an opportunity to build on my sense of social justice and community development, which has seen me go into other jobs, into leadership roles, into state government and local government. And then, as I was saying earlier, more recently in the Australian Red Cross, where I was their national head of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander programs.
So what would, when you were in classrooms around Queensland, what would that be, 15 years ago?
Yeah, about 15 years ago.
What was it like for a Murray woman, strong in her culture, in classrooms, and you're quite fair-skinned, like myself? What was it like 15 years ago for a Murray woman teacher in the classroom?
Yeah, well, now that I think about it, it was actually more like 20 years ago that I was in the classroom. So there were times when it was a little bit confronting, you know, where there were still teachers that, you know, were there teaching kids who hadn't actually come to terms with how they saw cultures other than their own. So, you know, there were moments where I had to spend a bit of time educating my colleagues about particular issues and how they behave and, you know, how they interact with cultures other than their own. And I guess that is really, you know, that's one of the responsibilities that First Nations people have in whatever job that you have, particularly if you're working in mainstream Australia, but really any job that you have. You have your job that you have the responsibility of doing, and then there's almost another 50% of your work is has to be committed to having those conversations that help build understanding and education and, you know, and there's that work of advocacy that happens that's beyond your actual job description. Mm. So that's, you know, that's a challenge that we all have to face.
Mm.
And I know Billy's had the same experiences.
I'll get him to tell us a little bit about his background soon. Have you ever wanted to be white, wishing that you was a white fella? Because if you're a white fella, how I see it was, you could cruise through life and not be too worried about anything, not be confronted by too much or challenged by too much. But a black fella, even if you're a single parent or a carer with a few kids, you're still challenged and confronted every day because of your culture, because of your environment and what you choose to do and where you choose to go and stuff. Have you ever thought about, I wish I was white?
Well, that's kind of like asking me if I wish I was ever a man, you know? It's like, I mean,
well, you would never want to be a man.
I'm sure you'd never want to be a woman either.
No. He's got too much to go through.
You know, I guess...
But has it ever crossed your mind, like thinking the difference between the challenges, the conflict and stuff for a Murray?
You know, funny you raise that because my grandmother, my beautiful grandmother, who passed away quite some years ago now, when I was really little, because I, you know, I am fair skinned, and when I was really little, she used to say to me, you know, you can walk amongst them and they'll never know. And I had no idea what she was talking about because for me, I'm just who I am. I don't feel like I have to explain that to anybody or have to think differently or anything like that. But she did have a point. But as I've gotten older, I've understood more, I think, what she was trying to say. And that was, you know, there are extra responsibilities for me, extra responsibilities, because I can walk amongst them. And it takes a while for them to realise that they're talking to an Aboriginal woman, a First Nations woman, a Quandamooka woman. It takes a while. So there's, you know, there's a whole heap of responsibility in there. And quite honestly, there are times when I think, oh, it'd be so much easier if I didn't have that responsibility, if I didn't have the extra that other people don't have. But quite honestly, when I think about my grandmother and I think about my parents and my aunties and my uncles and people like
and your Tiger country.
And my country, how can I ever not take up that responsibility? How can I ever not want to be who I am? I can't.
You said your parents were very focused on education, saw it as a priority. What do you put that down to? Were they denied or didn't get through, were forced to leave school early, go to work and stuff? What was it that brought them to say, well, your kids are going to get a good education, not a better, but a good education? I don't know what sort of education they had. Mm. What do you put that down to?
Well, I guess my dad, he was the eldest of 15. So, you
15
know, a
children?
Massive family. Not all survived, but, you know, really a huge family. The Enochs are, we're a really big family. you know, even when you look at first cousins, and you know how our mob, you know, status, family status is, you know, first cousins is the same like brother-sister.
Brother-sister, that's yeah. right.
So I have 42 of those, you know.
Wow.
So it's a massive family. And I'm the eldest of all of those as well. So I'm the eldest of the eldest. But, so massive responsibility. My dad, his father passed away unexpectedly when he was 41, just had a massive heart attack. And, you know, passed away. So my dad, at the age of 16, 17, all of a sudden had the responsibility of raising a family. But prior to that, living on the island, it was pretty tough raising that many kids.
Mm.
And so my dad, pretty much at the age of 10, was doing a man's job. And by the time he was, you know, 12, 13, he was out cutting cane. He was no longer going to school. And that was part of his responsibility to step up as the second man in the house and help, you know, get the money that was needed to
carry the burden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he didn't really get a chance, you know. He had other things that he had to do. And, of course, we've had legislation in place, of course, that wasn't too helpful around that either. My dad, who has only just passed away this year, he was an incredibly intelligent man. He knew lots of, like, he could read and write. He learnt lots of, he used to read the paper. He knew lots of things that were going on around the world. He could tell you exactly when was the right time to go fishing for a mullet and when the oysters were on and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
He knew all that stuff. But he understood pretty soon after he had kids that the world was the way it was, and that the only way that we could make things better is if we had well-educated mob who were able to get into the systems and to make a difference. And so right from the beginning, from when we were very little, he was very passionate about making sure we all had a good education.
Mm. Mm. A common story, I suppose, with our mob, with younger ones like yourselves coming through. Billy, whereabouts are you at the moment, brother? What part of the country?
I'm in Cairns.
You're in Cairns. All right.
Yep.
All right. For you, was there education, like a university education for you? What's your story?
Well, I went to university. I didn't finish, but growing up in my household, my family, I'm a grandson of a cane cutter. My grandfather cut cane in and around the Innisfail district. He's what they call a gun cutter back then when they didn't
All
have
right.
harvesters. Yeah, they used cane knives, and I'm the son of a cane farmer as well, and a railway worker. Dad was on the railway. So from a very early age, I learned the importance of hard work or having a job particularly, and what that meant for your self-esteem, but also the quality of life that we enjoyed. You know, we're a strong working family, and so working values, I think, is something that I've always, was instilled in me when I was younger. No, I don't think I've ever been out of work. I think it was twice I can remember being out of work, 3 months each, and it drove me crazy not being able to find work. But I'm, very fortunate, great role models there. I remember seeing my grandfather go off to work at the crack of dawn and come home after sundown. And, that sort of, like I said, that was a value that was instilled in me from a very young age and continues to be something that motivates me and drives me. It probably has a lot to do with my involvement with the Labor Party, actually, at Tiger. And, back then it wasn't too good to be a black fella in my grandfather's day. And, he definitely didn't have the rights at work and working conditions that we do now. And so growing up, and I do remember seeing him or hearing sometimes, he'd travel long distances for work only to get and walk into the farm and the farmer says, oh, sorry, Jack, we can't use you today, or no, I haven't got the work that I said I'd have for you last week, and then he'd have to drive home again, or they'd be shifty on the price, and the price he agreed to do the job for, when they spoke about it, was a different price by the time he got to the paddock, and And that was a bit of a deliberate ploy by some of these farmers to get out of paying him, you know, what he was, what the job was worth and what his labour was worth. So, you know, from a very early age, I understood that, you know, one, work was really, really important and valuable, and that contributed to, or gave me the opportunity to live a greater, you know, quality of life, a better quality of life. And secondly, you know, I sort of understood how important it was to, you know, stand up for the rights of workers. And, you know, somebody asked me the other day, why the Labor Party? And I know that there's been this, you know, traditionally the party's been the party of Indigenous Australians, First Australians. And there has, that suffered, that reputation, but also that you know, a lot of people have started questioning that over the last few years. None more so than, I think, Warren Mundine a couple of years ago in The Australian talked a bit about how, you know, the Labor Party's lost its way with Indigenous people, and particularly around Indigenous candidates. And I've got to say, I was really pleased to hear of Leanne's endorsement to represent the Labor Party in the seat of Alger for the next state election. She's more experienced than I am, and I'm very, very warmed and heartened by the fact that she's been endorsed. But it says a lot about the Labor Party. You know, the Labor Party is still and always will be the party of the worker. And, you know, I've said this to, you know, the person who asked me why the Labor Party, related to them that story about my grandfather and my father. And I think it was the same for a lot of black fellas back in those days, you know. And we've still got a long way to go when it comes to equality and social justice in this country. And unfortunately, when I look around the political landscape, I can't see too many parties that actually are probably going to be be able to champion those causes or those issues. We've still got a long way to go in the Labor Party as well, but that's why we need, you know, black fellas like Leanne and I to get involved in the party at this particular level. You know, there's a lot of work to be done, and I think...
Certainly.
Yeah, and we encouraged, you know, it was encouraging for me, because I don't know if you realise, mate, I actually was the candidate for the seat of Leichhardt for the Labor Party in the last federal election as
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. You've got a little bit of experience behind you there.
It's a bit character building, you know, I was really pleasantly surprised to learn of Brucey Gibson also, who was the Palmer United Party's candidate that contested that same election in that same seat, but also to look around and see people like David Rapinda over in, WA. I think he was running for the Nats for the Senate ticket. Warren H. Williams for the Greens in Central Australia. I think there was a young fella up in the seat of Melbourne running for the LNP. And whilst, you know, they are different political parties, I think by and large it was just really good to see that type of participation by Indigenous people in this process. And, you know, my grandfather said to me, there's one of two ways you can deal with something. If you see something you care about turning to crap or something, he said, you know, you either sit on the bones of your backside and you whinge and complain about it, or you get off your bum, you roll your sleeves up and you get your hands dirty and trying to be the change that you want to see. And I think that's, you know, I speak for myself, but I'm pretty sure that's Leanne's motivations too, is actually, you know, this is not a glamorous job. This would definitely get paid a hell of a lot of money. There's a dark, dirty side to politics. But you never shy away from standing up for what you believe in.
Yeah, yeah. We'll come back more into why both of you... Billy just explained why you get roll your sleeves up, get your hands out, and get in there and be the change you want to be. But first up, Leanne, give us an update on the stolen wages.
Oh, yeah.
The last time you were in, we spoke about stolen wages and the Uncle Conrad Yateman case. Mm. That case has been finished now, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
State government saying no.
Yeah, so what happened was... earlier this year, the Queensland LNP government made an application to the courts to have a permanent stay on all proceedings against them by Uncle Conrad Yateman, who was taking the state government to court to redeem his wages that he believed had been stolen. We went to... So that application was heard by the district courts last month, and there was about 3 hours of toing and froing between the two legal teams presenting the case for why we should be continuing on to hit so that Uncle Conrad could have his day in court. And unfortunately, what happened was that the judge decided to rule in favour of the Queensland government, which basically means there is no day in court for Uncle Conrad. That is the end of all proceedings. He'll never be able to come back and redeem to seek his redemption of his wages, which is outrageous, for one thing. But, you know, to add injury to insult, after the judge, you know, made clear his deliberations, our legal team, or Uncle Conrad's legal team, sought some sharing of the legal costs, but the LNP government had instructed their legal team to not share costs, which meant that all costs for all the legal costs fell at the feet of Uncle Conrad. So, you know, that's just... So not only did he have his wages stolen, not only did he not have his day in court, but now, on paper, he is responsible for all the legal costs.
Wow, isn't that rubbing salt into the wounds?
It really is.
Denied your wages, and then because you want to question it and argue your case, to have your time in court to argue your case properly, oh no, we're not going to, we don't see that you have a case there, so you pay all the costs.
Yeah.
Wow.
But, you know, I mean, I guess when you hear Uncle Conrad's story, that is pretty much indicative of how it went for him during the time when his wages were being stolen, when he was working particular hours and he was expecting to get paid a certain amount of money for that. He tells stories about when he and others went to question where their wages were and getting a good beating for it, like getting a good flogging for asking where their wages were.
Daring to ask.
And don't come back and ask for that again. Yeah. So, you know, he is an amazing man. He has stood up the whole time and said, no, I'm not signing these pieces of paper. I'm going to go ahead and, you know, take on the Queensland government and retrieve my wages. So I guess the positive thing is that the Queensland Council of Unions and the union movement in Queensland, who are passionate about wages, of course, and workers' fair rights, we have been supporting Uncle Conrad in the legal battle, and we'll support him on these costs as well. So he's not going to be taking that on personally, thank goodness. But that doesn't mean that it's all over.
That's what I was going to ask. Where's the Queensland Council of Unions have been supportive and arguing the case that because you've taken the balance, because the Queensland government has taken the balance, I think just over $20 million, and placed it within the Queensland Indigenous Education Foundation. Mm. That's stealth the second time.
Mm.
Where does that, and then the Queensland Council of Unions, Ron
Monaghan,
Has said, we'll argue this case. Is there still a case for the council to continue with that, regardless of Uncle Conrad's outcome?
Yeah, there is. And look, I guess, you know, that, this is the thing, the union movement in Queensland and in Australia will never, ever stand by and see a worker, regardless of their cultural background, regardless. They will never see a worker have their wages stolen from them, and they will never see somebody treated so unfairly in a workplace. They'll never stand by and let that happen, and they'll never give up on it. What we have in terms of the legal environment we have now, it's almost impossible to chase down individual wages. The judge has made it clear that, you know, the records are pretty much non-existent. They've been lost or damaged. They're not sound. It's a long time ago, is what the judge said. So the memories have faded slightly. And we don't have people alive who could bear witness to what had happened. What we've got left then is the fact that in 2002, the Labor government at that time, in recognition that wages had been stolen, set up a reparations fund, some $55 million set aside for reparations for those people who had their wages stolen. You know, it's not the ideal. It's not every cent that you ever earned, but it was recognition that we just had no idea of how deep the it had gone in terms of how much it was going to cost. So the reparations fund was set up. What happened only a few years ago was that that reparations fund, you know, it had an onus of proof on it, so it made it quite difficult to prove that you actually were deserving of those funds. So when that process was exhausted, there was about $21.2 million left in the fund. The government at the time had decided that they would redirect those funds into an Indigenous education fund. The stolen wages claimants and supporters at that time were outraged and felt as though the wages had been stolen once again. So our goal now, as part of the union movement, is to have that $2.2 million made available for reparations. So we want those funds, the reparations funds, reopened. We want the onus of proof, or, you know, how you prove that you were deserving of that money. We want that lowered so it's a bit easier for people to prove. And we want the $21.2 million distributed. So the Queensland Council of Unions, along with the Stolen Wages Support Group, maintaining a campaign around that. And you'll see us at Musgrave Park at the Family Fun Day on during NAIDOC Week on the 11th of July, with a petition that we're putting together that we'll present to the state government later in July, demanding that those three things be done, that they reopen the reparations fund, they lower the onus of proof, and they distribute the remaining $21.2 million.
Thanks for that. It's good to see ongoing action and support by the Queensland Council of Unions. Billy, this was... I commend you, Leanne, and all those other First Nations people that choose to put their hand up and get involved in major political parties and then take it a step further and stand as candidates in elections. When you look at what the Labor Party has done, it was Beattie and then Anna Bligh. I mean, I was involved with the State Stolen Wages Committee here, and I think we met with something like, and I haven't been, I've been out of circulation for a year or so. We met with five different ministers in my time, and they were mostly Labor Party people. It must be, I don't know, disheartening, disappointing to see a government that you want to stand for and represent in order to represent your mob, and in order to keep on going with things within the Labor Party. It must be disheartening for you, some of these sorts of kicks in the guts, I suppose, like Uncle Connor, even though it's an LNP government now. How do you keep on going with this stuff? What keeps you motivated, keeps you moving?
When it comes to stolen wages and this fundamental grievance that our old people have with the state, with the government in relation to these funds for these wages, I'm with Leanne on this 100%. But I'd like to say, too, it's one of the some things in politics that just need to happen. There's some things that just are so right that they just need to happen. I don't care which government does it. I don't care which politician does it. But this fundamental grievance that we have in the state of Queensland when it comes to stolen wages needs to be settled, and settled once and for all in a way that I think is satisfactory and deserving and has some justice about it. And like I said to you before, Tiger, you know, when you see something you love and you care about going down a road that you don't think it should go down, what do? You know, and for people like Leanne and I, well, I won't speak too much for Leanne, but for people like myself, you know, like I said, I could sit and I could complain and I could, you know, or I could, like I said, get involved in the party in a way that I never thought I'd get involved and try and change things, you know. I still think, by and large, there's more good than bad in the Labor Party. There's, you know, successive Labor Party governments that I think have failed to address this issue. But, you know, I've chosen to say, well, look, I'm going to stick with these guys and, you know, I'm going to try and make that change. Like I said, be the change that I want to see happen. And I think the Labor Party is very open to that. I think the Labor Party recognises, you know, that for them to have this ongoing or, you know, very happy relationship, you know, healthy long-term relationship with Indigenous people in the state of Queensland particularly, that they need to start engaging with Indigenous people and bring Indigenous people in at all levels of the party. And I'd hope to think that people like Leanne and I are successful in the next state election. And then our voices become a bit more, you know, I guess we have a bit more say in the direction of the party and some of the social policy. And so all of a sudden there's people like her and I that actually are shaping some of this policy and putting and having some input into how we should be addressing this issue. I saw a bit of optimism around that and a bit of faith in the party to be able to, you know, I think make some changes. And like Leanne said, chart out a course. I think where stolen wages are back on the table, that is reparation, you know, that program gets reinstituted with a few changes so that we're making sure that we're actually, you know, one, recognising that this has happened, and two, responding to it in a way that we hope that, you know, is amicable and for all parties.
There's more and more of our mob First Nations people getting involved, and you, some of you, or both of you, I think, have identified different parties that First Nations candidates stood for across the country over the last few years. With a First Nations party, Maurie Ryan, for example, that's got to be a good thing, where First Nations people also are sort of stepping outside of the mainstream parties, but it'd be a harder road to travel maybe, or bigger challenge, I'm not too sure. But how do you feel about that? But just the fact that First Nations people want to engage, they want to be involved, they as Billy says, Leanne, we want to be the change that we want, become the change that we want to see happen. How do you feel about the First Nations parties and things like that?
Well, my belief is that the more First Nations people who are involved in politics, involved in the conversations about where our country is going, where our state is going, the better. So however that looks, I'm happy for that. You know, I've chosen the Labor Party similar to Billy's story. Mine is based on values. So I see values in the Labor Party that match my personal values and my cultural values. And so, you know, to be a part of all of that, to have conversations inside those particular parties that take those values and shape behaviours, shape policies, is absolutely crucial. And if there's anything that I can put out there to everybody is join parties. Make your own party. That's great. But we want Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people involved in every level of political conversation. We really do.
Billy... lost my train of thought. Billy, there was a federal election that you was a candidate for the last time around, and now it's a state election. You've obviously got a bit of a hunger there for politics.
You know, somebody said to me, I remember hearing from a very, you know, early part of my involvement with the Labor Party, somebody said, look, if you feel that you have the ability to do good for people, then you have a moral obligation to do so. And I was telling you a bit about this earlier. You don't do this for the glitz and glamour and the fortune of fame. You do it because your heart's in the right place. And if you think you can help people, you've got a genuine, you know, you genuinely feel that you can help people, then you do. So, you know, the federal campaign was a really good experience for me. I guess the party, to a degree, wanted to take me out for a test drive and see how I went. And you know, our numbers from that campaign were pretty, pretty good, particularly up in... Because the seat of Cook, for those the listeners that don't know, the seat of Cook actually sits sort of smack bang within the boundaries of the federal seat of Leichhardt, which I contested. So it's basically the Cape and Torres Strait minus Cairns.
So you're able to capitalise on your experience of last time around, where people know you, you got some good results in from some of the communities and stuff. So you're able to capitalise on that now with the state election coming up next year sometime, whenever it's announced.
Well, look, you know, the numbers I got in the Cape and the Torres Strait and some of those southern areas were really, really promising. And you know, I think if we were contesting the state campaign on the night of the federal campaign election, I would quite possibly could have been the member for the state seat, but of course we weren't. So, it is quite, you know, one, the numbers are there, two, the profile's there now, and the experience, you know. I came through that federal campaign feeling quite buoyed, actually. People said to me the day after the election, said, you know, oh, hope you're okay, you know, please don't go waste, you know, stay involved. And if people really knew exactly how I felt, I felt more encouraged and more focused and more determined more than ever the day after the federal campaign to continue, you know, on and take the next opportunity. Politics is all about opportunities, and I think Leanne will tell you that as well. Mm. And, you know, you don't pick your moment, the moment picks you, and you've got to be ready. And I think it was time, you know, whilst I didn't have a plan to run for a federal campaign, when the opportunity presented itself, I took it with both hands because of what I talked to you about before. You know, there's idiots on both sides of politics, brother, and I'm going to be honest with you in saying that. And so people have lost faith in politics and politicians, and Leanne and I have done some training over the weekend down in Brisbane there. We talked a bit about this growing swing vote, you know, this growing
voter base of disillusioned voters, of disenfranchised voters that aren't really grafted on Liberal National Party supporters or Labor supporters. People are looking for, you know, like I said, I've lost faith in politics and politicians. And, you know, both Leanne and I have decided to put our hand up and say, look, you know, instill a bit of faith, I think, in our individual electorates. Into, because we're both good people. I listen to Sister Leanne speak, and I see a degree of experience and commitment and passion about her and her community particularly. And I know in my heart that Leanne does this, not because there's some, you know, pot of gold at the end of this rainbow, but because at the end of the day, I think we feel we've got a contribution to make.
What'd you learn? What'd you learn from your last, from that experience standing in a federal seat? When you said you felt real good coming out of it, and people are saying, I thought you might have been disappointed, disheartened and stuff like that. But what'd you learn from it?
I learned that I think people like you for who you are as a person. And if you're able to go through that process like that and still be true to who you are as a person, you know, Brand Billy worked really well. You know, I didn't find myself having to actually step outside and pretend to be someone I wasn't. And I think that came across. And the direct voter contact that I had in that campaign was really, really good, because that's the most gutsiest part of a campaign, knocking on a door in some, you know, well-to-do suburb, and here you are wearing a red Labor shirt and you're a black fella, and you're out there trying to sell this message about, you know, a Kevin Rudd / Julia Gillard government, but, you know, that wasn't really popular. But at the end of the day, people were warming to you as a person, and then ultimately they warmed to the message, I guess. And so that's what I learned about it. You know, stay true to yourself. And, you know, if you know, people, I like to think that people still, you know, still think I'm the same bloke that I was. You know, it was a surreal experience, I've got to say. You know, it was quite daunting at the outset. And I kept wondering, you know, one of these mornings I'm going to wake up in a cold sweat and think I can't do this. But and I was waiting for that morning to happen, brother, and it never did, you know. And I think because, like I said, I think you kind of had a really firm belief and firm understanding about what you believed and why you were doing what you're doing. You're committed. And you don't do this on your own, too. You know, family makes sacrifices, you know, and family, you know, supports you. And you know, there's a team of people that were supporting me that, you know, I can't thank them enough.
Yeah,
but, yeah, that's what
important.
I learned about it. The other thing I learned about it, too, mate, is that, you know, for every 10 people that think you're a good guy, there's another 15 or 20 around the corner big you're a goose.
you know,
everybody happy, but you
that's
know.
That's right. Yeah.
But Billy, I think Billy is so right when he says you can only be yourself. So, you know, you can only be the person who you are, and all the values that you have and the connections that you have, you know, it shines through, and people see that goodness in you and that commitment and the passion and desire in you, you know, and they connect to that. And so if you're there with good intentions, with a good heart, a good soul, and you're talking to people from that space, then, you know, it doesn't damage you the same way that might for people who might want to, who think they have to be someone else. You have to be yourself.
Yeah. Leanne, there's some electoral reform or rules and that, like ID being required to be presented on election day. Tell us about this sort of reform and how it's going to impact on people. Is it a national policy? Is it just state?
Yeah, well,
what's the situation?
This is actually something that is going to affect, I think, Billy's constituency more so than other locations, but it's a huge issue. What the LNP government in Queensland have decided is to so you have to have identification. It's a requirement to vote now. They're saying that there was some rorting in the system and that to overcome that, people need to turn up with their ID.
This is bloody near all white fellas doing this rorting. No black fella been involved in that rorting that I know of, but anyway.
Well, you know, in 2009 there was a federal group.
I don't know, but the majority of the people are voting or them mob there. But anyway,
Either way, in 2009 there was a federal green paper that reported on 10 cases of multiple voting that was referred to the authorities. 10, not 10,000, 10. And that was from the 2007 election. So this idea that there are people out there who are going into multiple booths to vote several times so that they can skew the result is a fabrication. It's a falsehood. And I know Billy has some views on this. Yeah.
What's that, Billy?
Sorry, Leanne.
You're right.
Sorry. Look, and the Queensland Attorney General, Jared Blaise, own department, as late as last year, middle of last year, commissioned a report into, you know, this voter fraud as well. And one of the things that they found is that his own department's advice in this paper, this research paper, was that this voter fraud doesn't exist. It's not a problem here in Queensland. So any time a government acts against its own advice, I think, you know, we have to be concerned about it. And let's not mince words here. It's something I feel really passionate about. And you know, I am challenging for the Cedar Cook, and the Cedar Cook takes in the Torres Strait and Cape York communities. And I think that any laws, any time we introduce a compulsory need to show identification to vote, will marginalise and disenfranchise Indigenous people. Not only
Absolutely.
Indigenous people, but people with disabilities.
That's
people,
right.
People that are homeless, people that are elderly, the young. And if you're homeless, you're black and you're in a wheelchair, that's a triple whammy. But this is not about democracy. Let's be very clear. I want to be very clear with our listeners out there. This is not about democracy. If there's one thing that governments should fight for and stand up for and preserve, is the right for people to, for their voices to be heard. And if our most vulnerable and marginalised in our communities are going to be marginalised and disenfranchised by this law, then I think shame on the RNP. It's, you know, my grandfather told me, never expect something from someone you know they can't give you. And when it comes to social justice, when it comes to rights, well, this government, let's not expect something from them they can't deliver on. This is something I'm going to be campaigning about strongly in my seat. A lot of black people in the Cape and the Torres Strait turned out to vote for me. And, but it's not just about me. It's not just about that fact. I want people. My grandfather fought for rights. You know, he got on a train with old Uncle Joe McGinnis here and went down in Cairns here and travelled down to stand up for rights for our people. This is a step back. Whilst this doesn't take away people's ability to vote, it makes it increasingly hard. And it's, like I said, the government's own paper, the state government's own white, the discussion paper about this, came back and said, this isn't an issue. You know? So
That's
you have
right.
to ask, well, then what are the motivations then of this government to... And it's purely political, you know.
So is it law now? Is it law? Is it the policy?
I understand it's been passed into Parliament.
It has
It's the electoral
passed.
Queensland Electoral Reform Amendment Bill.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure. I was talking to Curtis Pitt, the member from Mulgrave, the other day, and he mentioned that it's been passed into law. Stafford, the next by-election, this by-election happening, I think maybe the first election where voter ID will be implemented. So, you know, it's a good grassroots election issue for me to go out there and campaign on, and I definitely will be. I'm going to have to raise the awareness of the fact, one, because I was in Arakoon last week, and not a lot of people knew about the fact that, well, nobody knew about the fact that they have to take ID now. And two, I'm going to have to let them know exactly what type of identification is going to be acceptable when they come to polling stations. But, hey, that's the cards that you get dealt. There's no shortcuts in some of this stuff, and, you know... it is a state, Queensland state, exclusively Queensland state issue, but I think it sets an ugly precedent around the country for a whole bunch of people.
When you guys win your seats, not if, when you win your seats, will you be encouraging the party to reverse that law and fix things up? How do you feel that you would go in that argument with the Lab Party? Leanne?
We are certainly, most certainly, discussing this in the Labor Party, and I can say that our colleagues are saying it has to be stopped. This is an outrageous abuse of executive power, and it has to be stopped. The idea of pretty much excluding a whole groups of people because they don't have the correct identification to be able to vote is absolutely against every sense of democracy and the principles of freedom. Absolutely against that. So, you know...
What will they accept as identification? A lot of our people don't have licences and don't drive, Billy. What will people... What's acceptable as identification? When people go to vote...
Mm-hmm. Well, in that discussion paper, I had a look at what they were proposing. Utility bills, obviously photo identification, driver's licence, passports, 18-plus cards. It's a combination of a few documents, not necessarily just photo identification, I'd like to make. But I do know I worked in the state public service for a while and have been in the department of communities in Mornington, Normanton and Doomadgee out there at West and Mount Isa. And I do know that that identification is a big issue. People just haven't got the basics. And so...
Well, there's a lot of our mob, Billy, that where there's 10, 15, 20 people in a house.
Exactly. And look, somebody...
For those that are lucky enough to be in a house, there are a lot of our mob that aren't in a house too. Long grass mob or people out in the park or wherever, you know?
And these are legitimate issues, mate. You know, somebody said to me the other day, well, look, we've just been encouraging people to take their electricity bill along. Well, if you're in a house, if you're in a three-bedroom house in Arrakeen and you've got seven adults and 10 mm-hmm. children living there, that covers one person.
That's right.
You know, it doesn't cover the whole household. So, you know, we've got to get some clarity, and actually that hasn't been worked out from what I understand by the state government. But they passed this legislation. I passed this legislation, but they haven't worked out the nitty-gritty of this stuff. As soon as we find out, you know, we'd definitely be out there, you know, talking to people about, you know, what are the forms of ID that they need. There's letters from the Electoral Commission. So people need to, you know, it's going to be a big exercise, you know. Like Leanne said, disproportionately, my electorate of Cook is going to be affected more than some of the inner-city ones, or southeast Queensland electorates. But... you know, like I said, it's a good grassroots campaign issue for me to get out there and campaign on, and I will be doing that. Yeah.
And it's like Billy was saying, it's clearly a political move. It's,
of course.
This legislation is clearly about political position. I mean, in 2012, the Queensland state in that state election, there was one case of electoral fraud. One. So to go to all this effort to change the legislation. To make it more difficult for people who are already marginalised to take up their democratic right as citizens of this country and cast their vote, clearly there is something else going on here. You know, there's huge questions to be asked of the current LNP government.
They're grubs. They're grubs. That's all I can say. They are grubs. But then again, I say that about most political parties, but particularly the ones that are sitting in government. You need a hell of a lot of resources. We've got a couple of minutes left. What do you need? Is there anything that you want to say, Leanne?
Yeah, I guess Billy will be in the same boat as myself, but obviously we are facing an LNP government who have been storing up all their money for this next campaign. They're currently spending tens of millions of dollars campaigning around their smart choices, strong choices, smart choices, millions and millions of dollars. So they're out there already just, there is a wall of money that's coming with them in terms of their campaign. You know, they are so arrogant that they believe that they deserve another run at government. They've already set their agenda of what they will be doing if they receive a mandate. So even if just they win by one vote, even if they win by one vote, they have told us what they'll do. They will sell our assets. They will sell our assets, they will privatise our services, which they are already currently doing, and we all know what that results in. Higher electricity bills, poorer services, less jobs. So they're already telling us, and they've stored the money up, and they're going to be spending it like there's no tomorrow. For people like Billy and I, we don't have that same war chest. We're not from rich families. We don't have a whole heap of rich mates that we can call on to help out. And we're not in government rorting the system like this LNP government is. We need people and we need funds to be able to run our campaigns. We're not going to ever have the money that the LNP have, ever. We're not going to have that. So people power is what we've got. And, I'm sure Billy will have the same call for action and support. But for me, in the seat of Alcester, which takes in Forest Lake, Alcester and down to Hillcrest and Boronia Heights, I need all our mob in southeast Queensland to come out and help me, to help me knock on doors, help me ring people in the electorate so that I can change people's votes, make sure that I get in and that we make sure every vote counts and that every vote is against the LNP so that they do not get the mandate to sell our assets and make the next generation pay for what they're doing today.
Billy, you've got a big area to cover. You're driving for hours and hours in some cases,
forever,
community.
But, But that's the way I want it, mate. That's the way. I wouldn't have it any other way. Lots of people to see, lots of people to talk to, but the support's out there. And I think the message is clear. And if there's one thing I want to leave your listeners today with is that this state government is a government that doesn't care. This state government is a government that's arrogant. And this state government is full of a bunch of people that have got nothing in common. Nothing in common with you or I.
Yeah. Yep, you're right there with that one. Well, look, guys, we're past the approaching news time. Really appreciate you giving us your time to talk about this because, like I said earlier, I got to congratulate you people and all our First Nations mob that do stand up to be elected, stand up for a particular electorate and stuff, run as candidates. I congratulate you. Keep up the great work. And like you say, the more people we got in there, doesn't matter where it's at, LNP, Palmer United Party, Labor Party, we've got to be represented. We've got to have a voice. Thank you very much. And we can only hope that you do well. That's the end of the program for today. Join me tomorrow for Let's Talk on your local First Nations station.